Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jonathan Coppell of the Yale School of Management, who explains why he believes a trickle-up approach to addressing the financial meltdown would be more effective and fairer than a bailout of those on the top. BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast, who discusses how the Republican Party is attempting to disenfranchise Democratic voters in this year's presidential election and how these votes can be protected. And famed prosecutor and best-selling author Vincent Bugliosi, who talks about his new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The final destination of Russian tanks aboard a Ukrainian freighter hijacked by pirates off the coast of Somalia has raised some questions. The cargo includes 33 T-72 tanks, rocket-propelled grenades, 23 anti-aircraft guns, and ammunition. The Kenyan government says it purchased the equipment for use by its military. Yet the U.S. Navy, whose ships have surrounded the hijacked ship, say the tanks are actually headed for southern Sudan, where the regional government, run by former rebels, has run its own military since the signing of a 2005 peace agreement. According to the Los Angeles Times, recent skirmishes between the forces of southern Sudan and the Khartoum government in the oil-rich region of Abyei has the former rebels feeling vulnerable. Yet the purchase of Russian military hardware is allowed under the current North-South peace deal. The Somali pirates are holding 20 Ukrainians and Russians hostage. They are demanding an $8 million ransom, reduced from the original demand of $20 million. The incident has drawn the attention of European governments. 8 European defense ministers have pledged to create a new task force to combat piracy off the Horn of Africa. According to The Nation magazine, the oil-rich state of Alaska has much in common with the oil dependency of petrostates like Oman in the Persian Gulf. Both locales pumped out 700,000 barrels of oil a day in 2007, and oil accounts for three-quarters of all exports. If federal aid to Alaska were deducted, oil taxes would account for over half of state revenues, the same as Venezuela. Since becoming governor 2 years ago, Sarah Palin has sought to make Alaska even more dependent on oil and gas reserves. She pushed through a new oil tax that includes a surcharge on every dollar of net profits that exceed $30 a barrel. Oil companies can get much of these funds back through tax credits earned through investments in infrastructure and exploration. Palin also lobbied hard for a new natural gas pipeline to Canada that will spend $500 million in state financing. Before running for vice president, Governor Palin became a leading opponent of subsidies for renewable energy like wind and solar. Surely, at this moment in history, writes Michael Clare for The Nation, with oil output in decline and global warming, anyone opposed to government support for renewable energy should be considered stupendously ill-equipped for national office. 33 conservative ministers have defied a ban by the U.S. Internal Revenue Service on political endorsements from the pulpit by members of the clergy. The campaign by the ministers is supported by the Alliance Defense Fund, a right-wing legal group who hoped to challenge a 1954 amendment to the federal tax code that bars nonprofit tax-exempt organizations such as churches from engaging in political activity. Eric Stanley of the Defense Fund told the New York Times, "This is not something these churches want to do in secrecy and hiding. In fact, they do not believe they are doing anything wrong." The Liberal Interfaith Alliance has released a list of 180 clergy who have pledged not to endorse any candidate for president. Interfaith Alliance Chairman Rabbi Jack Moline declared, "Endorsing a candidate from the pulpit is saying, 'This is what God says should be the government of the country.' I think this is a nightmare scenario." In defying the IRS ban, Indiana pastor Reverend Ron Johnson blasted the positions of Barack Obama on abortion and gay relationships from the pulpit as violating biblical scripture. However, Johnson did not formally endorse John McCain. The IRS says it is monitoring the situation and has not yet acted against any of the conservative ministers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
After the fear and anxiety surrounding the financial collapse on Wall Street and the initial rejection of the $700 billion bailout by the House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate sweetened the deal with $150 billion of unrelated tax cuts and passed the plan. The House then reversed course on October 3rd, accepting the nearly $1 trillion Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, with President Bush signing the measure the same day. Business and government leaders hoped the bailout deal would begin to calm the markets and unfreeze credit, but Wall Street stocks continued their precipitous decline, followed by a plunge in markets around the globe. Before the bailout bill was passed, other actors proposed various alternative solutions, but were dismissed as both the Bush administration and Democratic leaders in Congress insisted their package was the only one that would be considered. One alternative rescue plan was offered by Jonathan Coppell, who co-authored an October 1st op-ed piece in the Washington Post calling for a bottom-up approach that would provide direct relief to homeowners in trouble. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Coppell, who is director of the Milstein Center for Corporate Governance and Performance, a research and policy center at the Yale School of Management. He summarizes his proposal and explains why he thinks the government may still come around to his idea or similar approaches.
We were saying that the government refinance all these distressed mortgages so that they would essentially give new loans to the people who were in danger, were in default or in danger of default, pay off the existing loans, and then there would be hopefully an affordable payment would be created by doing that, right? So instead of it being an adjustable rate loan that the monthly amount goes up and up and up, it'd be a fixed rate 30-year, say, loan at a relatively reasonable interest rate, say 6%. And that would make it possible for people to make payments and stay in their house. In some cases, however, the payment would still be too high, and so you would have to figure out some way of transferring a portion of the equity in the house to the government, right? So in some sense, the government would co-own the house with you, and the government would get its money back when you sold the house. You know, you could have the person pay a small rent on the portion of the house that the government owns, for example, right? So obviously the homeowner would be getting a big benefit, but it wouldn't be free in the sense that it was costless and that the person who was making their payments in good faith and hadn't defaulted would be still better off than the person who was accepting this bailout. But it just seems like a more reasonable, fair way to have this transfer of wealth to somebody who messed up, right? No matter what you do, somebody who made a bad decision is getting bailed out by the government. So the question is who? And it just strikes me, and I think many people in the country, as grossly unfair that these financial industry firms are going to get a bailout while Americans are going to continue to have foreclosures and lose their homes and so on. Also, from the point of view of efficacy, the problem is not going to go away until you stop the foreclosures. People are going to keep defaulting on their loans, and the economy is getting worse and worse, and people are losing their jobs. This is going to keep happening. And so, unless you do something like this, and I believe that even though the bailout passed, something like this will happen, because we're going to be in the same place 6 months from now, 8 months from now, when the next wave of foreclosures comes through.
So given that the people with the ability to make these decisions didn't go for that idea at all, were you in favor of the bailout?
I'm not 100% sure that we shouldn't have just let the market do what the market's supposed to do and sort out winners and losers. And that, I'll say that, and then at the same time defend the decision to do it for the following reason, which is to say it's easy as an observer, to sit back and say, well, how do you know it's going to be so bad? Right? I mean, everybody says it's going to be terrible, but they're all self-interested. Right? It's all coming from the very people who are going to receive the benefits of the bailout. On the other hand, if you're Congress and everybody's telling you, act now, or we're going to plunge the country into the worst economic disaster since the Depression, you want to roll the dice? You know, that's easy to say. It's not necessary. On the other hand, I sympathize with the people put in this position. I also sympathize with people put in this position when I think it was irresponsibly made an up or down referendum on a plan which was mediocre, in my view. You know, obviously I suggested an alternative, so I think there are other ways to do it, but I would never in a million years suggest that my alternative, or the alternative suggested by me and my colleague, was the only alternative, which is exactly what the administration and more or less the Democrats in Congress did. And I think that's insane, right? That, you know, the idea that it had to happen immediately without any thought, without any consideration of other options was crazy. And the position that everybody was put into in Congress, which was either you're for us or against us in some sense, that was a crazy position to be put into. And if I were in Congress, I would have been very, very resistant to accepting that kind of approach.
There are signs already that very serious problems, and you know, people getting laid off, and you know, small businesses shutting down, and so on. How quickly can this be turned around?
Oh well, turned around is, I don't think things are going to turn around in the sense that all of a sudden all the arrows are going to start pointing upwards. The question is, how do we avoid precipitous fall? So first of all, the question is, how quickly can the Treasury Department implement this? That's a big question. I don't know. It's a complicated thing, what you're supposed to do, right? That now, what the bailout says is that they're going to purchase all these assets from the financial institutions, assets that are completely unsellable today, and the government's going to buy them and figure out what the price is for these unsellable assets based upon some valuation looking to the future markets that are healthy. Well, you tell me how to do that. Nobody knows how to do that. And so that has to be figured out in a way that's both efficient, right, gets the money out there quickly, because that's the whole point, but also doesn't leave the government in a position where they lose hundreds of billions of dollars in the long run, because the idea is that we get this money back eventually. Well, that's not so easy to do. Moreover, the reality is that even if this works, it doesn't deal with the grander economic forces which are pulling everybody in the world down, not just the U.S., but everybody in the world down. So there's nothing that's going to turn that around on a dime. I mean, we've got another minimum, 2 years of rocky economic times ahead, I would say.
That was Jonathan Coppell, director of the Milstein Center for Corporate Governance and Performance at the Yale School of Management. Contact the school at area code 203-432-8070 or visit the center's website at milstein.som.yale.edu. Voter suppression has been a feature of U.S. elections for almost as long as the nation has existed. But since the tumultuous 2000 presidential election, where massive and deliberately flawed purges of Florida voters played a critical role in determining George Bush the winner, activists and watchdog groups have focused attention on the activities of GOP political operatives working to disenfranchise Democratic voters. Along with the inexplicable anomalies in the counting of electronic voting machine ballots in Ohio during the 2004 elections, tens of thousands of votes cast primarily by people of color were improperly thrown out across the country after being labeled as spoiled. Now, with the 2008 presidential election less than a month away, BBC TV investigative journalist Greg Palast, who was the first to report the 2000 Florida vote purges, is warning of a repeat of Republican voter suppression tactics in key battleground states this November. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Palast, who, along with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., wrote a new investigative comic book-style guide titled Steal Back Your Vote, 6 Ways They're Stealing the Election, and 7 Ways You Can Steal It Back. Palast discusses the various methods being used to invalidate the votes of blacks, Latinos, students, and senior citizens, and how these votes can be protected.
The big ways they're going to steal it, or have stolen it, is by purging the voter rolls, just like Florida, but on a much more massive scale, and with the blessing of new federal law called the Help America Vote Act. You know, George Bush is trying to help us vote. So, for example, the New York Times has picked out Colorado as probably the swing state. And there I discovered, investigating the files, I discovered that the Secretary of State of Colorado, Republicans, have knocked off 19.4%, that's 1 out of 5 voters, knocked one out of five voter names off the voter rolls. The result is that the Democrats who think that they're going to get this state because of the change in registrations towards the Democrats are going to find out that those names ain't there on November 4th. So that's number one. And by the way, the Secretary of State that did this massive purge, the Catherine Harris of Colorado, was named Danetta Davidson. George Bush then picked her up and made her chairwoman of the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission so she can show all the other secretaries of state how to do this mass purge game.
Now, how can we reverse that if you feel that the fix is already in some of these critical swing states with the voter purges? What can people do at this late date, just a month before the 2008 presidential and congressional elections? What can we do to reverse that?
Much, much, much. One of the things we say is register and register and register. What we mean by that is check your registration. We give you places you can check your registration. Now, I know people think, well, I've been voting for years. This is my third presidential election or something. Forget it, baloney. Under new federal rules, they can knock you out if you've been voting for half a century, as they did with nuns in Indiana. Check if you're registered, number one. Two, check and make sure that that you are registered under your correct name. You'd be surprised how many people have errors input into the machines, which will make a difference now because you're going to have to show ID, which you had to do before. Find out exactly where you're voting so you don't end up being told, no, you're in the wrong voting station. If you are purged and you show up at the voting station, don't accept what's called a provisional ballot because they don't count those things. 3 million people had provisional ballots dumped on them in the last election. Almost all of them are black and Hispanic. So if you're white and you're listening to this, you probably don't even know what a provisional ballot is. You may find out this time the hard way. Don't accept it. We give an 800 number in the comic book to call in a lawyer. You want an adjudication on the spot to give you a real ballot. That's the type of thing you should do. That's just the beginning. We have six ways they're stealing the election, seven ways you can steal it back.
Greg, we've been reading about the voter purges of people related to their home foreclosures in Michigan, but it's not limited to Michigan from what I understand. Tell us a little bit about how the Republican Party in Michigan specifically has been purging voters who've had their homes foreclosed.
While McCain has now given up on Michigan, this is a big issue in Nevada and Florida, also two swing states where over 3% of the homeowners in the entire state are facing foreclosure. So now what do you do? What the Republicans are doing is they're using foreclosure lists to mail people letters. It's called caging. Mail people letters, do not forward if they're not at their home because they've been foreclosed. They use that as evidence that they're fraudulent voters. You don't lose your vote because you lose your home. That is, in fact, illegal, but they do it anyway. And what they're doing is that they say, well, they're not really at the address that they're registered at. So what? Most states have a two-month grace period where if you lose your home, you still get to vote there. If you stay in the congressional district because you've moved in with friends or relatives or neighbors, you still get to vote there even if your address has changed. And even if you've moved somewhere else in your state, you still get to vote for President of the United States. You're supposed to be given a special ballot. So you're not supposed to lose your vote for president just because you've lost your home. That is illegal, disgusting, and ugly. The question is, are the Republicans deeply involved in it?
What kinds of things do you think have to be put in place at the federal level to prevent these kinds of manipulations and voter suppression tactics? Is there a way these people can be prosecuted, that these political activists can be prosecuted?
Yeah, I mean, one of the, as you know, Bobby Kennedy's dad, Robert F. Kennedy Sr., was U.S. Attorney General. And as he pointed out, when his dad was Attorney General, they would arrest these people. Now, the Justice Department not only doesn't arrest people for blocking voters, it's part of the conspiracy. If you go to stealbackyourvote.org, you'll see David Iglesias, the fired federal prosecutor, who said he was fired because he refused to bust innocent voters simply on the grounds that they were trying to make a case that there are all these fraudulent voters, which didn't exist. Now, that's obstruction of justice. People should go to jail for that. Karl Rove has been subpoenaed and has been ducking the subpoena by the Justice Committee of the House. You know, in the old days, Kennedy Sr. busted the guys who ran the Jim Crow operation, even though they were in his own political party. Remember, Jim Crow was a Democratic Party operation. Bobby Kennedy busted Democrats for suppressing the vote. Today's Justice Department under Bush is busting the prosecutors who try to prevent voter suppression.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter and best-selling author Greg Palast. Read his articles online at gregpalast.com. Download a copy of Steal Back Your Vote at stealbackyourvote.org. In his newest book, famed prosecutor and best-selling author Vincent Bugliosi makes the case that President Bush should be charged and tried for the murder of thousands of U.S. soldiers, resulting from his launching the Iraq War. Bugliosi, a former Los Angeles County prosecutor who was best known for his successful case against cult murderer Charles Manson and the book he later wrote about it, titled Helter Skelter, maintains that Mr. Bush has committed the most serious crime ever committed in American history, by taking the nation to war in Iraq under false pretenses. The book, titled The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, presents a meticulously researched legal case and documented evidence that President Bush knowingly lied to the American people to justify the war, which cost well over 100,000 lives on all sides, spent over $1 trillion, and undermined America's reputation and credibility around the world. Bugliosi says that despite a corporate media blackout on reviews and TV interviews, his book has become a New York Times bestseller. The Progressive Party candidate for Attorney General in Vermont, Charlotte Dennett, recently pledged to prosecute President Bush if she should win office this November and says she would appoint Bugliosi as the state's special prosecutor in the case. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Vincent Bugliosi about the case laid out in his book and the importance of holding President Bush accountable for his actions in Iraq.
What American killer in American history is responsible for over 100,000 deaths? No one even remotely comes close to that. Now, that's assuming that George Bush is guilty. And that's what the prosecution of George Bush for murder is all about. I present evidence that proves, beyond all reasonable doubt, that George Bush took this nation to war, Scott, in Iraq, on a lie, under false pretenses, and therefore under the law. He is guilty of murder for the deaths of those 4,000 young American soldiers who have died so far in Iraq fighting his war, not your war or my war or America's war, but George Bush's war. And I always tell people, let's not forget the over 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, children, and babies who have died horrible deaths. He's guilty of those murders, too. However, I was unable to establish jurisdiction here in America to prosecute him for those murders over in Iraq. I was able to establish jurisdiction here in America to prosecute him for the deaths of those 4,000 soldiers. In my book, I put together a legal case against Bush that could result in his being prosecuted for first-degree murder in an American courtroom after he leaves office, Scott. Right now, he has temporary immunity. Once he leaves office, he has no immunity from prosecution at all. In the book, I set forth the legal architecture for the case against Bush, the overwhelming evidence of his guilt, and I also present in the book the jurisdiction to prosecute him. I told the House Judiciary Committee on July 25th, when I testified before Congress, that at this stage of my career, I don't have time for fanciful reveries, and I never in a million years would propose a prosecution against Bush for murder if I didn't feel there was more than enough evidence to convict him and that I was standing on very strong legal ground. Charlotte Dennett, she is a viable candidate right now for Attorney General of the state of Vermont. She announced at a press conference with me in Burlington, Vermont on September 18th that based on my book, if she wins, her office will seek a murder indictment against George Bush and appoint me special prosecutor. So what that means, if I can capsulize it, is that if Charlotte Dennett wins on November the 4th, I will be taking this case to a special grand jury in Vermont, and I have every reason to believe that I will get an indictment for murder and conspiracy to commit murder against Bush, Cheney, and Rice, maybe more. So this is no longer theoretical, Scott. We're talking about something very tangible here. So if your audience wants to prevent George Bush from getting away with murder, they should support Charlotte Dennett for Attorney General in Vermont. Vermont, by the way, has the highest per capita loss of soldiers in Iraq of any state in the Union, so it's a very fertile state in which to go after Bush. It's the only state, apparently, in the Union that Bush has not set foot in.
And so I want to ask you about the reticence of many people in this country to believe that a former president could be prosecuted for this war in Iraq. There are many people out there who would maybe love to see the prosecution of George Bush, but they're skeptical, they're cynical that that could happen in our country. There are others who maybe will say, well, the September 11th attacks were a mitigating factor and you have to give him a break. Maybe he stretched the truth to protect us. I'm not saying I believe that, but you know there are many out there who do. And there are others who will say, hey, this is going to be a public humiliation of our president. So I want to ask, in your view, why is accountability so important in this country when our nation's credibility is at an all-time low in this world?
I thought in America, maybe I'm wrong, that no man is so high that he's above the law. He's not above the law. Why is it important? Well, he's got to pay for his crimes. What about the fact that because of this war, for the first time in this nation's history, the majority of people around the world no longer look up to us? They have negative feelings upon us. They have negative views of America for the first time ever. If we want America to be the great nation it once was, we can hardly do that, Scott, if we don't take the first step of bringing those responsible for the war in Iraq to justice. Let's also think of this. Let's also think of deterrence, which is one of the main reasons why we have laws on the books. If we want to deter future presidents from doing something as monstrous as George Bush did, that deterrence is going to increase immeasurably if some future president that gets a funny thought in his mind knows what happened to George Bush, that he was prosecuted for murder. If we don't do it, then, you know, they say, well, apparently in America you can get away with murder if you're the president. So you asked me a tough question, but the bottom line is that no man is above the law. And if he's guilty, he's got to be prosecuted for murder. We cannot let this guy get away with it.
That was famed former Los Angeles prosecutor and best-selling author Vincent Bugliosi. His new book is titled The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.